It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. So what comes next after the women's marches in Washington and in New York and in cities just about everywhere? Will it be a massive one-day event or the beginning of an ongoing mobilization that can change the political equation, like the Tea Party, for example, change Congress? If you attended a march this weekend, call in and tell us what you do next or anything else you want to say. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And we'll talk to author and New York Magazine and Elle Magazine writer Rebecca Traister in a couple of minutes. But as your calls are coming in, here's a montage of some of the calls we got covering the march. The callers seem to come from literally everywhere.
Good afternoon, Brian, and bonjour tout le monde. That's hello to everyone in the world.
We are at the New York City rally. We are so excited to be here. The energy is beautiful. It's powerful. It's strong. It's feminine with lots and lots of men. I am born and raised in Portland, living in Sacramento, and here with a group of us in D.C.
The Boston Common is packed today. I don't think I've ever seen so many people on the Boston Common at once.
I'm down here at the capital of Arkansas, and we probably have at least 5,000 men and women and children down here right now, and they're still coming up.
Beaumont is in the very, very corner right next to Louisiana and New Orleans. We're just a hop, skip, and a jump from there. Very, very, very conservative. We really have been really excited about how many people have joined, because we didn't think we were going to get that many.
We're Americans living in London, and we had to participate. I think that there were plenty of Americans there. There were a lot of Europeans, plenty of Londoners with families.
There indeed was a march. It started at 2 o'clock this afternoon at Trocadero. We had a fabulous backdrop of the Eiffel Tower. And there were just hundreds and hundreds. I can't even tell you how many people were there, men and women.
I just had an ability to participate in a great march. The media is reporting about 3,000 people today in Amsterdam.
We've been marching here also in Vilnius, Lithuania, marching for women's rights, marching against violence. And, of course, we still believe and hope that U.S. will remain the lighthouse of democracy, freedom, and human rights.
Callers to us over the weekend from the women's marches on Washington and cities around the world. With me now is Rebecca Traister, New York Magazine and Elle Magazine writer and author of books including All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation, published last year, and Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. By the way, that was the election of 2008. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So where did you choose to spend Saturday?
I was in D.C. And it was just, I'd been watching and writing about the organization of this march, for the really just handful of weeks over which it had unfolded. And I was very optimistic about it. I was anxious about it at the beginning, right after the election. It seemed beset by problems. But then as I saw the incredibly capable organizers take over, I just became incredibly optimistic about it. And I felt like it was going to be important. And I had just a good gut feeling about it. But I have to say that even with that, I could not have fathomed both what it was like to be there and just and I've been to big marches in my life. I have never been to anything like this. I've been to big women's marches in D.C., including 89, 92, and 2004. And 2004 was, by many accounts, the biggest women's march, perhaps the biggest march in D.C. Mm. And I think it came in at around 750,000.
I've read that number.
Yes. This seemed, you never can get a straight answer about crowd size, as we have learned. This seemed to be a million people. It was an endless sea of people. You'd cross one march and then you'd go to another street and there'd be a different set of marchers going around. And I could never have predicted the scope and the numbers around the world. It was just, it is a breathtaking, sort of earth-shaking event, I think.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey Public Radio, and we'll start taking your phone calls in a few minutes on where you think this movement, if it is a movement and not just a one-day event, goes from here. Where will you as an individual, if you attended something on Saturday, go from here? 212-433-9692. Rebecca, is it possible that the marchers were in effect talking to each other while Red America shrugged or got more alienated? Because we already knew Trump is unpopular globally, and we knew he's unpopular in American cities, even the cities that are located in red states.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is that that montage that you just played, that was Red America too, right? And we forget in this, I think in the post-election desire to talk about who lives in a bubble and who doesn't, one of the things that we forget is that plenty of those people at marches, they do live in Red America, and not just right. in the cities. They were coming from communities perhaps to the cities.
Well, that would make a difference because, you know, I think Red America, Blue America, there's been a lot of talk recently about how rather than state by state, it's more city versus rural, and then the suburbs are divided. So Dallas, for example, in bright red Texas, voted majority for Clinton.
Right.
And so, you know, when people call from Houston and the city of Beaumont, as we heard in the montage, maybe it's not that surprising. But what do you think that the attendance was so big because people have gotten turned off to Trump even more since the election? Or what does
yes.
it mean?
Well, it means a lot, and it's hard to – so one of the things we've learned post-election, there was great polling done that was released just last week by a firm called Perry Undum that actually showed that even amongst some Trump voters, even amongst Republicans, even amongst people living in red states, the anger at Trump – over the comments specifically that he made about women, and also a feeling that there should be more women in elected office, was pervasive regardless of your political affiliation. It's really worth looking at this polling. There have been some reports on it. Again, it's by Perry Undum. And one of the things that the pollsters found that was fascinating to me, they asked a question about whether or not you are more likely to participate politically in the election, in politics after the election. And the majority of people said yes. A majority of people, including those on the right and the left. And they did a regression analysis to say what most predicts an eagerness to now participate more in political life, including to pay more attention to what politicians do, to speak out more. And they found that the predictor was not whether you were liberal or conservative, is not whether you were a man or a woman. It was the number one thing was how you felt about Trump's comments about women. The number two thing was, do you think that there should be more women in elected office? And the number three thing was anger. Those three things turned up before you even got to where are you ideologically on a political spectrum. So I think it's erroneous to say that there's this breakdown simply between red and blue America. And I think this march, where there are lots of people who've never marched before, lots of people who've never been engaged with, you know, with women's issues or with racial justice issues, and that's what it was. It was a march organized by women in the name of women that was a coming together of all kinds of issues around racial inequity, immigration rights, criminal justice reform, climate justice, And those people were talking to each other. And I do think it is a mistake to think that even those people from cities are not from towns, do not have family, do not have friends with whom they are talking about this. I think we cling, you know, much too much to this idea that people who live in cities are in a bubble and that there is no lifeline, no love line between the cities and the more rural and suburban red America.
Kathy in Lakewood, you're on WNYC. Kathy, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm a first-time caller, so thank you very much.
I'm so glad to have you on. And I see you were a marcher from Lakewood in New York City on Saturday?
I did, yes. It was a phenomenal march. I was very deeply moved by the commitment of the people that I saw and marched with. So, yes.
You're a first-time caller. Were you a first-time marcher?
No, I had marched in the climate march, but that was the only other march that I participated in.
So what comes next for you? Anything concrete?
Yes, I thought about it a lot after I left the march because I thought it just can't end here. We need to commit to something more. So on my basic local level, I intend to contact the high school principal and propose a citizenship day where we can go and register the senior class that would be 18 years old and ready to vote in the next election. So that's my plan.
Very concrete. Kathy, thank you very much. Monica in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Monica,
yes,
thanks so
good
much.
Morning.
Hi, thanks for
thank
calling.
You for taking, thank you for taking my call. I'm a Chinese American, and I'm 61 years old. I've never protested, never marched, but I marched in the Women's March in NYC, and it was an amazing experience. I did so actually at the advice of, against the advice of some of my friends, because they think that I could be getting into trouble, so to speak, because I studied a little bit about Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. I also studied about the Chinese Revolution, and my family and friends actually were affected by it. And I saw the very quick rise, consolidation, and abuse of power. I mean, actually less than a year in both cases. And many people would say to me, oh, well, you know, it's just 4 years and we'll just, even though we may have elected the wrong people, it's fine because they would go away. I do think that the world and the country could be very much compromised in just 6 months or a year, and there's a sense of urgency.
So for you,
my question is, how do we regain our power to truly make a difference?
And I'll let Rebecca answer your question in just a second. I'm just curious for you then, the motivation for you to take part was not so much women's rights per se, but this general fear of creeping authoritarianism?
Yes, and also women's rights and also immigrants' rights. I mean, I think all of the various issues that we are seeing in this new administration that are very frightening. You know, I was very much in support of all those issues, but I also have been feeling chills up my spine as I look at history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being a very global citizen, you know, I'm very much connected with the rest of the world, which I think many Americans probably do not care as much about. I'm actually concerned about not just this country that I love so much, but the world.
Rebecca Traister, meet Monica in Stamford.
Hi, Monica.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Well, I think you're very eloquent about your acknowledgement that all of these issues and your concerns are so interconnected. And that was one of the tremendous and I think transformational lessons of this protest, because it was a march that acknowledged, it used the banner "Women's Rights or Human Rights," which is a line that derives partially from Hillary Clinton's 1995 speech
at the Beijing
Women's Conference. But there's this acknowledgement there that we have been far too slow to really absorb, you know, even, you know, in the United States in terms of activism, which is that women's rights are so frequently treated as this ghettoized sort of subset of the larger progressive agenda. And there's no acknowledgement that women are more than half the population, and more than that, that the entire population is connected to women in one way or another, familially, professionally, socially, economically. And so that women's rights are, I mean, this is, it seems, this most basic statement, but we have been too far from understanding what that actually means. So that we talk about women's issues as sort of separate from economic issues. Even in this recent election, we talk about social issues like abortion or reproductive rights, and then as somehow different from, say, you know, separate from economic issues like the minimum wage. But of course, the minimum wage is a woman's issue. Two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women. Tipped workers are women. Wage inequality is a women's issue that disproportionately affects women of color, which means that issues of racial justice are women's issues.
And this goes, for example, to one of the reasons that Bill de Blasio rose over Christine Quinn in the 2013 mayoral race. He made a big stand out of her as city council speaker, blocking the paid sick leave bill. And he said, that's a women's issue, because who's going to benefit from that guarantee more than low-income women?
Right. Of course it's a women's – paid sick leave, paid sick days, subsidized daycare. And I think there's been this temptation, oh, well, these are women's issues that – and really until recently they were really out of reach. They felt like third rail issues. And there's been this grassroots activism that has gotten state and city measures for paid leave and in some cases subsidized daycare passed, and that wound up on Hillary Clinton's very progressive platform this year. But those are the heart of economic issues, right along with wage hikes. But there's this interconnectedness that I think everybody has been a little bit slow. And I count people within the women's movement as it has existed. I count people in the greater progressive movement who've seen the women's movement as subsidiary somehow. And what this march did that I think was thrilling was bring together in the way that is correct the notion that women can lead the progressive movement forward and that men can show up behind them and alongside them.
So Monica in Stamford, who I don't think needs to be convinced, wants to know, what do we do to preserve our power?
Well, right now, in terms of actual practical political power, we don't have a lot of it. I mean, one of the things that we're battling right now, and I'm talking about the actual elected power, we have extreme right-wing leaders in the White House, the Senate, the House, and in 68% of state legislatures. We are, when it comes to elected power, at a real disadvantage. However, the things that people are doing, I think it is a mistake to say that this march was all that there is. You have already seen a sort of unprecedented amount of people who've never been involved in politics before understanding what it is to call or write to their local representatives, finding out who represents them in Congress, in their state legislatures, writing them, showing up at their office, protesting, getting the message to them that they do not, that this is not what they want, that this is not what they're going to vote for going forward. It actually helps that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 2.8 million votes, because I think it reminds us that this was not what the majority of voters in this country wanted. I think that actually helps psychologically. It's not a minor detail. It also sends a message to the rest of the world. The other thing is that there has been organizing already taking place. It's funny, the group Pantsuit Nation, which post-election was this secret group on Facebook that got together to support Hillary Clinton. And after the election, most of the coverage of Pantsuit Nation has been kind of derisive coverage of a book deal that came out of it. But in fact, that group has spawned all these local organizing groups where they're doing everything from deciding on issues, local priority issues about what they're going to, how they're going to address their state representation, their local representation, to planning, suggesting who's going to run for office. Emily's List, the group that is dedicated to electing pro-choice Democratic women, held a training on Sunday in D.C. the day after the march. It was oversubscribed and sold out, women wanting to run for office. I think we're seeing a huge wave of women wanting to get into politics themselves. So there are a lot of avenues already open.
And organizing already taking place. I hear that list of specifics that you're starting to lay out there. Monica, was there anything else you wanted to say?
Yes, the only thing I wanted to say is I want to thank you very much for the journalistic pursuit of reporting the truth. And I think right now we need to not just report the truth, but also prioritize what to report on, because I think Trump's tweets are just a lot of distractions that run people ragged.
Thank you.
And I just want to say thank you for the courage and the conviction.
Thank you very much for your call. We were talking about this last hour, Rebecca, with Charlie Sykes, who's going to be hosting a Wednesday night national call-in show here for the first 100 days of the election, part of of the administration, part of a Monday through Thursday night series that we'll be doing. But the idea that journalists have to, even if the journalists themselves are the ones being insulted, like over the weekend, resist the temptation to follow every Trump or his press secretary tweet or provocative statement down every rabbit hole, when we should be talking about the executive order that he issued on Obamacare the other day, which got much less attention,
right,
and other kinds of policy things like that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. He's very, I mean, it's tough to tell how much credit to give him for manipulating the media, but he is very good at setting up distractions. I mean, I have to say that for me, it's been easier to not pay attention to what he's doing. And actually, I mean, I'm paying attention to what he's actually doing, but some of his tweet diversions and everything are just so maddening that I have to look away.
Iman in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Iman.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Rebecca. I wanted to tell you that we went to the D.C. March, my daughter and I. She's 14 years old. It was extremely empowering, but it was definitely the first step for us. It's we see it as it was psychologically absolutely necessary to see the thousands of people surrounding us who felt the same way we did. Can I tell you what my sign said?
Sure. As long as it complies with FCC guidelines. Well, yes, if you'd like to say the P word, you can say the P word.
Well, it said, hands off my Muslim pussy. That's what our sign said. And we were disgusted by Trump.
I think that's called an intersectional sign.
It is. Anyway.
Yes, absolutely. We were disgusted by Trump's comments about sexually assaulting women and bragging about it. I wanted my 14-year-old daughter to feel that she, you know, after the election, she was so depressed. I was so depressed. And we said, okay, first we acknowledge our feelings, but then we move on and we start working. So what we've decided to do is we've established what we call our spider web, where when we hear a call out to call a Congress member, call a local politician, a state politician, a national politician about a big issue, then we reach out to our friends. I have seven friends who I reach out to. My daughter reaches out to her friends. The seven friends reach out to seven other friends, and we keep it going as far as we can so that it's not the march was not the end. It was just the beginning for us.
I think something that you said really, your story is incredibly just, it makes me happy to hear it. And in part, it's because of the what you describe about going to that march and realizing how many others there were out there. And one of the dynamics that I think happened in the wake of the election, we had this moment during the campaign around not just the tape, but then the women who'd come out and accused Trump of assault, and all of these women, millions of women around the country started talking about their experiences of being harassed and assaulted and touched. And I mean, I heard at that time from so many men who said, I had no idea. I'm learning so much. There was this moment. It was quite traumatic and unpleasant to live through, viscerally, really difficult. But we were talking about these issues, and there was this communication between women and men, and it felt like something serious was shifting in the comprehension of exactly what women's lives are like, the way that gender works in terms of how women live their lives in the world every day. And then after the election, it was such a shock and such a trauma, and I think there was also such an immediate desire, you know, to cast blame. How could this have happened? This shocking thing. A lot of the blame went toward Hillary Clinton, obviously some for some good reasons and I think some very bad reasons. A lot of the blame, I think, was also taken on by some of her supporters. There was a shutdown of this conversation. I mean, it has been crazy that since the election, we have had sort of 11 million takes on how white men voted and very few takes on how gender played a part in the defeat of the first woman ever nominated for president in the United States. We went from having this robust conversation about gender, where I think there was a lot of communication, to suddenly having this freeze. And I think for a lot of women, those who were invested in Clinton's campaign, and I think many of them who were not, but were nonetheless startled and horrified by the election of Donald Trump, it's felt like there's been this paralysis, a shock of 2 months. And something like the march this weekend was like, oh no, we're out here, we're still here, and in fact we can talk again about these things.
Iman, anything else you wanted to say?
No, I really just felt like I saw the light when I was at the march. You know, I saw that there was I felt so empowered, and so did my daughter. And then when she came back, we came back yesterday, Sunday morning. She said, "Mama, let's call Congress." I said, "Well, I think we're supposed to wait till Monday." And we wait for the call, wait for the issue, and then we make a call. But she was ready to go at 14, my little warrior.
Iman, thank you very much for your call. and my guest as we talk about what comes after the women's marches on Saturday is Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. There was a debate over kicking out the anti-abortion rights group that wanted to march as an official partner. Mm-hmm. I heard a leader of that group interviewed on Saturday who said they were going to march anyway, but not as an official partner because they were genuinely anti-Trump. They hate his misogyny. Mm-hmm. They hate his xenophobia and authoritarian tendencies, but they differ on the issue of abortion rights. Do you agree with the decision to not let them partner?
I completely agree with the decision to not let them partner. But I also applaud the what I think was a very clear message sent by organizers, which is you're invited to march. And in fact, I have a picture of it somewhere. At some point, I got pretty close to the lead banner being held by the organizers as they finally marched after the presentations and the performances. And sort of right behind them, there were two signs right next to each other. And one was, I support Planned Parenthood. And one was a pretty clear anti-choice sign, but it was, you know, anti-abortion feminists.
Uh-huh.
And they were marching right next to each other very happily. I am very, very strongly on the side of the defense of reproductive rights in this country and the expansion of reproductive rights and access. I agree that anti-choice groups should not have been part of an organizing and that their anti-choice mission is at odds with the principles and platform of this organization. On the other hand, it was pretty great to see these two people who differ so strongly on this issue able to march side by side really close to the head of this march.
Yeah, of course, the image that got out in the media was that they were excluded, not that they chose to march anyway, which, of course, no individual can be prevented from marching. And some of the kind of critics who are on your side say, after an election in which 53% of white women voted for Trump, talk about a gender issue, it would have been such a powerful coalition if this group was included to say, even if we differ on such a fundamental issue, women are coming together to say, not my president. Then maybe you peel off some of those white, more conservative women who reluctantly stood with Trump in the election.
Well, I guess I disagree that adding an anti-choice group is going to peel off more people. I really do not think that that's the issue that divides. Polling that's been done over the past couple of years, we've always just agreed to this thing like, oh, the country's riven on abortion. It's 50-50. You can't really get anywhere. That's not true. The polling that we've begun to see over the past couple of years, in fact, the first week of January, a Pew poll showed that after the election, support for Roe is at an all-time high at 69%. Polling on not whether you yourself individually, not how you feel about abortion, but whether you think it should be legislated, whether you think it should be illegal. Now, regularly, that polling shows that 70% of Americans are on the side of legal abortion, in one form or another with differing restrictions. But so I don't think that that's the path to drawing those white women in. I also, you know, so... And I think that reproductive rights and access is so fundamental to the economic, social, sexual, professional equality of women in this country that I do find it a non-negotiable issue when it comes to platforms, policy, and leadership of this organization. But that does not mean that an invitation is not always extended to those who may disagree on that issue but agree on so much else.
That's such an important distinction that you made. I think even though it's so obvious that when you talk about abortion rights, you're talking about legislating something. Because I've had any number of conversations with people who say, oh, I'm against abortion. I said, does that mean you think the government should have the power to tell every woman what to do and every – well, no, not the government.
Well, that's actually – that's one of the innovations they've made in terms of polling this question is they used to just ask, do you believe in abortion or not? And the first answer that someone would give is their personal opinion, no. But what they found was that often that no – meant, no, I personally don't believe in it or I wouldn't do it. But then if you ask it first, how do you personally feel about this issue and give them the chance to say, well, I wouldn't do it. And then you ask, do you believe the government should legislate it? They say, oh, no, of course not. That's the innovation in polling right there.
Kelly in Westfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, it's Carrie.
I apologize. It's the second time I've made that mistake.
I'm honored to be on this show. I was unable to participate in anything because of an injury, but this is a heavily Republican town I live in, and there were over 700 women protesting in my town on the morning, Saturday morning, as well as I know there were people who took buses to Washington and also went into the city. And I... am very interested in if anyone has any information about any really like tiny local things that were happening. Because if in this town of 30,000 people, 700 women were, or people, I'm sorry, were protesting, then I think it would just add to the whole, you know, empowerment and excitement about it.
Yeah, it was going on all over the place. We got calls from Pompton Plains, New Jersey. We got a call from Trenton. I think a lot of marches that maybe weren't really planned kind of broke out.
I heard a report, and I can't be sure of these numbers. I heard a report that there were 5,000 people in Asbury Park, New Jersey, which is quite a small town. I've heard there are places you can look online. I wish I had the numbers that I could cite off the top of my head that showed that just the sheer hundreds of marches all over the country and the numbers that showed up even in small places. You may have seen the picture of the women in Antarctica who were protesting. And my mother told me last night, though I couldn't find the image, that she actually saw a photograph of a lone woman in a tiny, small rural town wearing a pink pussy hat and holding a sign, you know, standing in the middle of whatever
a
march of one. But that matters in a tiny place, a march of one, a woman feeling connected enough to a network of other events and other protesters that she can get up by herself in her own town.
So, Carrie, do you have a plan for follow up?
Well, I do. I actually just found out on Sunday that there's a vigil that's occurring. Leonard Lance,
your congressman?
Yes, our congressman.
Republican
there's
congressman.
There's a vigil every Wednesday evening from 4:30 to 7:30, but I don't have more of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just add that my 15-year-old daughter, Lily, was so excited because we couldn't do anything because of my injury, and she... But we made a sign and put it in my front lawn.
What did it say?
It said Hillary Clinton. The statement Hillary Clinton had
Women's rights are human rights.
Women's rights are human rights. My body, my choice. So I had it up for 2 days. So we're really excited about that. It sounds like nothing, but when you can't do anything, it was really empowering to do something.
And in conservative Westfield, you didn't get any eggs or anything else with that sign on your lawn?
No.
You can keep that sign up.
I also found out that 61% of Westfield voted for Hillary Clinton.
Oh, well, it's not as conservative as you thought.
Yeah, which was really exciting also. I wanted to just make another statement and a comment about the whole thing about when that whole thing happened with Donald Trump and... that my husband, who is a gentleman, was shocked that when all the women who came out and said that all these that they had been harassed by him, he was in disbelief. And I think, and when people were speaking about this, the number of people, and I think that what I realized was that men who would never in a million years ever act that way or speak that way to a woman can't even imagine or fathom that this is how men act. And my husband's kind of a conservative, you know, guy. And so I feel like there is a disconnect between men who aren't really liberal, you know, but they're not people who would ever do that. And they can't believe it. Do you know what I mean? Because they've never experienced it, and they don't understand it.
I totally know what you mean. In fact, after that Access Hollywood tape came out, it seemed to me that the guys I knew were in two different camps. One of them said, you know, when Trump and Melania and others were trying to write it off as, oh, boy talk, this is how men talk. There are plenty of guys who said, yeah, this is just how guys talk. It doesn't mean he really did anything. This is how we talk. And plenty of other guys I know who said, I don't know anyone who talks like that in a locker room. So I don't know what that means, whether there are just, you know, different camps of men in America living different ways. But it's interesting that there was that divide.
I think it's also important that many of them were hearing from the women in their lives, whether it's their wives, their girlfriends, or their sisters, or mothers, or daughters, was that was how it makes women's experience of life feel, even if it's, oh, just talk. I mean, I think that there was something about that conversation, about hearing how the women in your life live their everyday. I talked to so many men and women during that period who just the revelation that women get groped or harassed or spoken to on the subway in New York City, for instance. And so many men saying, really, that's happened to you? And it's like, yes, that's like Tuesday. I mean, this is not like this wasn't. And one of the problems, and I had a colleague who wrote about this at New York Magazine, Liz Merriweather, is that women for a long time have only spoken to each other about this. It's such a daily part of our existence. Just whether it's catcalling or groping or something, you know, more physical than that. But I think there's been too rarely communication between women and men. And this conversation that was started during the election, I think this weekend was a continuation of it, and men showing up.
Interesting. All right. Rebecca Traister, you have a piece going up, or is it already up?
It may be already up. It's post-March coverage, yes.
Any minute now, Rebecca Traister on New York Magazine, post-March coverage. And while you're there, Reed, I didn't even get to ask you today about your really interesting article from the other day about how the law forces doctors to lie to women about abortion. So maybe we'll get to that another time. But
I believe we have time ahead of us. I believe we have years to talk about that.
So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come this morning. Stay with us.